Let's do a proverb, shall we? In the book of Psalms. Turn to Psalm 78 real quick. I just think this is appropriate given where we're going to head with David, studying him. Obviously a unique guy. Psalm. Sorry, I totally confused you. I shouldn't do that. Poor Haley doesn't even know what book we're in right now. So she's... See, I insult her. She's not even here to hear it. That's so disappointing.
What?
What? So what happens when you're late.
What?
Huh? What? What? No. Psalm 78. It's a long psalm. Very last couple of verses. Begins to talk about David and his reign in Israel. I think this is just a fascinating picture of him. As you think about this... And this has been kind of an ongoing debate. But as you think about David, obviously through 1 Samuel and other places we see, described as a man after God's own heart, right? What makes him a man after God's own heart at the end of the day? And I don't know that this psalm specifically answers it, but you'll see some hints in there. But that's always befuddled me as to why that is a description of him. An adulterer, a murderer, his sin list is... long, if you will, and significant. I mean, they're not minor, like, sins, I guess, if you'll, you know, if we want to grade sins, but this is a great picture of the type of guy that he is. So I'd love to come back to that question at the end. Look at verse 70, start there, 78:70. He chose David, meaning God, his servant, took him from the sheepfolds. You've heard that story. From the care of the ewes and the suckling lambs, he brought him to shepherd Jacob, or Israel, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. Now look at these two qualities. When you talk about David, this is the description of what makes him sought by God, or maybe the skill set that he brought to the table. Look at 72. Somebody read that.
With upright heart, he shepherded them and guided them with his skillful hand.
Okay. Mine says, so he shepherded them according to, number one, the integrity of his heart, and secondly, the skillfulness of his hands. He guided them with skillful hands. Number one, what do you see as David's role, according to verse 72? As king, what is his role? How is it described?
Shepherd.
He's a shepherd. So number one, he is there to shepherd the people. And primarily, that's what he's called to do. He is an under-shepherd. He is a guy that ultimately, even in his position as king, he's taking care of the flock, right? No different than what he did in the field at 13, 14, 16 years old in that day and age. Okay, so as a shepherd, he guides them according to the integrity of his heart, his characters, maybe how we would describe that, and guided them with his skillful hands and his skill set, his abilities. So we're talking about character, and we're talking about a skill set. And David apparently possesses both of these. He has the character of a man to do the job. And he also has the skill set, which we'll see put on display today. He's a brilliant politician in the way he's going to administrate Israel if we get to there today. But he also has a unique skill set to lead properly, unlike Saul did. He's got other gifts. Now, what happens, by the way, if you have the right skill set to do a job, but don't have the integrity or character to do it? What happens? Chaos, right? How so? Okay. I was talking to a guy last night, and he was talking about this company that he works for. They are a million, if not billion-dollar company. It is run very well. They make a ton of money, and he's in the middle of this, you know, lengthy food chain of people that are all about making money, and they're good at it, but they have zero character. They treat their employees horribly. They are all about the bottom dollar, and they don't care what it takes to get there, who they have to run over in the process. They are going to make money. And they do, right? You can't argue with the fact that it is very, very effective. They have skillful hands. They don't have a lick of integrity. They don't have any character. They don't care about the people. They are pawns. They're expendable. They're throwaway. We'll replace you tomorrow. Unless you make us a lot of money, then you're helpful. But if you care about the employees underneath you, so on and so forth. So it's a great example, right? And you guys have worked for folks like that, been around people like that. That is not a fun environment to be in, where people are clearly not concerned about you or any of the people that they are called the steward. They care only about money or the bottom line, okay? The flip side of that also brings trouble. What happens to you if you have a ton of character but no skill?
You can't, yeah.
You're broke. Good for you, right? You sleep well at night. But you don't have, you know, two pennies to rub together because you're too dumb to figure out how to do your job or whatever. Or maybe you're in the wrong job. So both of those are not good. Now, I would certainly take broken, have character, than loaded with none. But David apparently has both. And he's going to put that on display. We're going to see how he leads Israel. But as you think about that, that's always been, I think, a really cool description of who he is at the heart. He's a shepherd, and he shepherds Israel according to his character, the integrity of his heart, and the skillfulness of hands. Okay. Now, as you back up and think about that, what makes David a man after God's own heart? At the end of the day, how can Samuel describe David that way, given the life that we know he's going to have? We know about Bathsheba's coming. We know about Uriah the Hittite, who he's going to murder. We know about the cover-ups. We know about the sin. David's going to spend 16 months today in compromise, complete and total compromise for 16 months before he finally comes out of this hole. So what is it about David that makes this guy described that way? There's been other servants, though, right? I mean, we've got tons of people that have served God. Why is David unique in that regard? I'm not disagreeing with you. What is it?
Because God chose him to be.
Okay, it's certainly the case, but he also, there's something in his heart that isn't just chosen by God. He also demonstrates that in certain ways, right? He's going to put that on display. He's going to be a servant. He will seek after God, right? And he that's consistent throughout his reign, but with some bumps in the road.
I think, like, as opposed to Saul, who kind of seeks his own end, David, like, puts him first, and then I think when David, like, falters, you see, like, his confession and his repentance and his turning back to the Lord, like, yeah, all throughout the Psalms, like, just his repentant heart.
Yeah, I think that's super characteristic. And again, not wrong or right. This is just my two cents. But we see that in other leaders, yes, who falter, who confess. Moses did the same. He got put on the bench. We see other kings that do as much, right, that falter and repent. We see that with judges that do similar. It seems like that's not the key. Will, thoughts?
My only other thought kind of going off of what he was saying over there, agreeing, is what we read yesterday of, he knows God's appointed time for, like, he understands, like, I'm not supposed to kill Saul now, mm-hmm, or now, and lets that go. And yes, he has his sin with that, but I mean, so did Abraham have his sins with, uh-huh, his issues, but he's still credited with the, like, faithfulness. And
totally.
So I mean, I would look at that as the biggest piece would be the repentant heart, and also the willingness to, when, like, really make sure that he's going, okay, what is God's true purpose?
Yeah, agreed.
So yeah, like, I think it makes a good point. Maybe it's like just he trusts God the most, whereas like Moses, he faltered because he didn't know.
Okay, unpack that for me. How would he demonstrate practically that he trusts God the most?
Well, like, when he could have killed Saul, he didn't, and he basically is, like, not doing anything that would try to manipulate the situation. He's
okay. Keep noodling on that. I think you guys are barking up the right tree. You're not quite there. I think there's something, and maybe it was Israel this year that I went, that's it. I want you to keep thinking about it. As we study David, I think there's something you're not going to see in him that you're going to see or have seen in other leaders. And I think it's glaring, but not glaring at the same time. Okay, so just keep that in the back. Oh, yeah, now they're coming. No cheating. You've been to Israel. Compromise. What do you not see in David's life ever? What destroys the kingdom in 1 Kings 11 that I haven't taught you yet? There's one issue underneath Solomon that he does that God says, we're done here. Okay? We're done. Solomon, your reign's over, and your son gets these two tribes, and this other dude's going to get the other 10 because of it.
He stops focusing worship on still on God.
Meaning what? That's the only king that I can think of, not the only king I can think of, that's the only quality in David compared to other leaders, that David never has idols. There are never other gods. Did you guys remember seeing with the description of Michal, what she brought into her house with David? The household idol that was in her bed. Where did she learn about household idols? From her dad, right? We don't see blatant idolatry from Saul, but it's mentioned, right? Solomon is going to build altars to Chemosh and Molech on the Mount of Olives next to the temple to appease his pagan wives. It's filthy, bad, I mean, awful. And you're going to see so many other kings do the exact same thing. David, you don't see it. You don't see idol worship in his life. You see sin, you see repentance, you see a heart, but you always see him focus on God and God alone. He doesn't go down that road. So just make note of that as we read. See if that seems consistent with what we'll unpack in the scriptures, but I think it's a fascinating picture of when God says, that is a person after my own heart, it doesn't mean their sin list is shorter. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're repentant and other people aren't, which I think is true and important, right? You can't live an unrepentant lifestyle, but David never turns to idols. He never puts his hope in anything other than Lord, Lord alone, okay? So with that, let me pray for us, and we'll dive back into 1 Sam, see if we can tie a bow on this book today. God, thanks for today, for your word. We pray that you continue to teach us, Lord, as we see David and a guy that, boy, just got, for a 40-year reign, a boatload of the story. And there's a reason that so many chapters and words and verses are recorded on this man, because he teaches us so much. So, Lord, could you help us to see our lives in light of him, to live his life a little bit, Lord, to walk in his shoes, to understand his pain, his triumphs, his victories, his defeats, the situations that he was in, that we maybe would better understand who you are, your grace to him, what you walked him through, and how we are maybe to respond in our day and age to similar situations that you put us in and that you walk us through as well. So God, teach us, we pray. In Christ's name, amen. All right. Well, we've seen in the last few days, again, the stripping of David that we talked about before. Israel, now to this point, we've seen David now walk through, again, a difficult season. And we ended in 1 Sam, verse 26, after David has had now two what I would call emotional highs. In chapter 24, he stands in integrity, has the opportunity to kill Saul. Remember, in the cave, Saul is relieving himself, his men, all 400 of them say, kill him. And David says, no, I'm not going to lift my hands against the Lord's anointed. And he passes on the situation, shows Saul the corner of his robe that he had cut off, and says, I'm not going to do it. Chapter 26, the same thing, just a different situation. He has the opportunity to impale Saul, you know, while he's sleeping, standing over his head with his boy Abishai. Says no again, but takes his water jug, his Nalgene that Max is now learning about. That was the funniest thing that happened to me yesterday, by the way. So it was true, prophetic. So you're seeing this. He's made two great decisions, and I think it's fascinating. 27 comes on the heels of that. We talk about often as leaders or with sin issues in our life or whatever it may be, it's not always in the tanks when that hits us. David is going to experience the greatest sin in this season of his life on high points, right? He just walked off of the issue with Nabal. He's brought in another wife. He maintained his integrity. He doesn't kill this guy. Abigail steps in, saves his bacon in the midst of having, you know, what would have been a very, very bad decision. So David arguably has come off of three significantly high point decisions. He's emotionally charged. And in 27, you begin to unpack this, and it just doesn't seem to fit. So 27:1, let's just unpack this and talk about it. Like, what in the world is going on within David that gets him here?
And David said in his heart, now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul.
Pause. What?
Now I shall perish someday.
Wait a second. Why? He just met with Jonathan like months or years ago. He's been reminded of the covenant. Can that happen? No, you've been anointed the king. You cannot die. But what's going on in his head? Why? It has been forever. Literally 11 years. He has been on the run from Saul. So the day he got kicked out of the palace in 1 Sam 18, 19, whatever that was 11 years ago. He's 28 now. He's 2 years away, by the way, from taking the throne, at least in the southern half of the the nation, but he's been living on the run for 11 years. Caves, scrounging food. I mean, you get a picture of what it was probably like with Nabal and that picture, I'll shepherd sheep and I'm a four hire guy. And he's got to feed 600 dudes. I mean, that pressure's got to get really old really fast. So this is drug on, not for just a week or a month or a couple months, 11 years. This is his life. I mean, that's miserable, okay? Keep going.
There is nothing better for me than that I should spin that I should speedily escape the land to the land of the Philistines.
Okay, whoa. He's done this before too. Yes. Yeah? So what's now his answer to I'm surely going to die problem?
Let's go back to the Philistines.
Like do you see the down spiraling in David's thinking, the humanistic reasoning, I'm going to die, like he's just rationally kind of playing this out in his head, but it's not attached to reality. This is what he feels, but this isn't what is true. And he's allowing his emotions to supersede truth at this point. So he says, man, this is going to happen. And if this is what's going to happen, then there's nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. You guys remember us talking about making decisions based on fear? I mean, those type of strong emotional responses never lead to good places. And that's where David's at. So this kind of pessimistic view on life. Then he said, Saul will despair over searching for me and for anyone in all the territory of Israel, and I will escape from his hand. So what's his ultimate end game here?
Outlast Saul.
Like, I just want to survive. I want to wake up tomorrow morning and not be on the run. Like, that would be nice. I mean, that's a pretty low goal, if you will, but that's how bad David's life is when you've done this for 11 years and you say, the heck with it all. So, verse 2, this thinking, this process leads him to crossing over with the 600 men to Achish, son of Maach, king of Gath. Same Achish that we met earlier, okay? Now, why would the situation be different? Why would David feel the freedom to return to Achish, where 11 years ago he tried the exact same thing, and Achish said, man, do I lack madmen that I need another slobbering fool in my camp? Get him out of here.
He has 600 men with him.
Okay, certainly that's a little bit more, he's got a little more bargaining power. What's been happening between he and Saul for the last 11 years? Cat and mouse. So if you're Achish and you're watching this happen, what are you thinking? Are they palling around anymore? Like, no, for 11 years you've showed me you're an enemy of Saul, and an enemy of my enemy is my friend. So David is on my team. Does that make sense? Like, clearly, Saul hates you. He's been trying to kill you for 11 years, so you must be my friend because that's my common enemy. So that's the idea. So David now goes to Achish and says to him, we'll see what he says to him. 13, or verse 3 rather. David lived with Achish of Gath, he and his men, each in his own household. David with his two wives that he's now acquired. And verse 4, look what happens. What was David's end game? Did he get it?
Yeah.
How did he get it? Would we agree that this is compromise? Would we agree that this is sin? That David's rationale, the way he got to this point, is not how God would have wanted him to get here. Yet what? Physically, externally, circumstantially, what does it look like? God's blessing my decision. Yes? Wow, where's Saul? He's been chasing me for 11 years. Now he's mysteriously gone. This is fantastic. This is exactly what I wanted. Now, the opposite of that is what? David's been living 11 years, for the most part, as best we can tell, how? The last 11 years.
In caves?
Spiritually, how's he doing?
Oh, good.
Good, right? He's obedient. He's doing what the best he can do, right? And what's happening circumstantially in his life for the last 11 years?
Horrible.
He's getting hosed, right? So tell me a little bit about David's theology. What does he, I think at this point in his life, and I'm reading into this a little bit, what does he believe about obedience? What should it result in? Not according to this. What blessing? If I obey, God blesses me. And when I live long enough and do that long enough and God doesn't do that, what does David do? Well, I'm going to take it in my own hands then. So do you see kind of what's going on in his head? It's a little bit of this God owes me mentality, right? And I think all of us that are persister achievers wrestle with this to some degree. God, I'm living my life a certain way. I'm not being an idiot. I'm doing the things that your book tells me to do. I'm not robbing. I'm not stealing. I'm not having affairs. I'm not murdering people. And yet my life is upside down. And yet I'm watching Joe Schmo over here that doesn't have the integrity that I have in the end of my pinky, and God is blessing his life. He's got money, he's got stuff, he's got all the things that he needs to survive, and he's a moral meltdown. Do you see David's theology? And boy, I wrestle with that as well. So David finally just says, you know what? I'm done with this. Screw it. I'm going to take it in my own hands, and that's exactly what he does. So it's a very dangerous theology to get into. Okay, that is where prosperity gospel and other things begin to leak in, where God owes you. It's kind of this tit-for-tat deal, like I've done this, God, now you hook me up, and God becomes my divine vending machine. And that's not at all how God operates. Now, God's got a plan, but David kind of supersedes it. And this chapter is going to get ugly, okay? So David lives there. He gets exactly what he wants. Saul quit searching for him. Verse 5, David now says to Achish, if now I have found favor in your sight, give me a piece of land in the cities of your country that I may live there. For why should your servant live in the royal city with you? Anything bother you about that? He's showing allegiance to who? Gath, his enemy. These are the Philistines. And he, again, is supposed to be the king, so he's now sworn himself to Achish, and he's asking for, basically, like, give me a homestead. Give me a place for me and my boys to live. Now, this is a bit shrewd, and I think David is, there's different ways you can look at it. I choose to look at it a little bit half empty because I think David's a lot half empty. Why would he want to live separate from Achish, separate from the Philistines? What's the half full version? Why would David say, you know what, let's, guys, the 600 of us, let's live in another city separate from them, these Philistines who worship Dagon and... Okay, yeah, we want to be separate, we want to be distinct. What do you think's the real reason?
He's just wanting to, like, scoot by for the next several years and then...
Yeah, you want to fly under the radar? I don't want that guy in my business. I don't want him knowing what I'm doing day to day. I want to have privacy. I want to have lack of accountability. Put me in some other random city, and I'll report to you back what I'm doing, but you don't have your thumb on me. I think that's exactly what David's doing. So Achish gave him Ziklag, okay, which would have been in the Shephelah, just north of Beersheba, but far enough away from Achish that there wasn't like this day-to-day interaction. They weren't neighbors. They are miles and miles away. So as a result, David would bring this guy reports, but wasn't necessarily underneath his control day in and day out. Okay, verse 7, this is kind of a chronological marker, if you will, for the entire season. It says that David lived there in the country for a year and 4 months. So 16 months, this is David's habit, and we're going to see what he does during the 16 months. Pick up in verse 8.
And David and his men and raided the Jezreelites and the Jerusites and the Amalekites for those nations were the inhabitants of the land from of old and as you go to as far as the land of Egypt.
All right, so we see a couple names. One of them we've never seen before. See the Geshurites, which is probably like modern-day Gaza Strip area. The Gerzites, we're not sure if that's a mispronunciation or a misspelling. We never see these group of people again. Regardless, they're people that are like enemies of Gath, but or of Achish, but kind of random. The Amalekites were down south. We've heard about them before. So these would have been normal wars that Achish would have said, oh, yeah, good. So you're my servant. You're fighting these battles. Okay, so that's fine. Verse 9, David attacked the land and did not leave a man or a woman alive. He took away the sheep, the cattle, the donkeys, the camels, the clothing, and then returned and came to Achish. Why would that be David's pattern? Why would he go to a city and extinguish everybody? Think about the season that David's in. Why would he not want any survivors to the places that he's going?
He would tell Saul.
Nobody can tell him. Not just Saul, but Achish, right? Achish says, hey, where have you been making raids today in verse 10? He has no report back from anybody. There's no survivors from these places. So David can pretty much tell him whatever the heck he wants to tell him because there's no reporting. There's no survivors. He hasn't brought people back. These are your prisoners, okay? Now, watch what David says in verse 10.
Wait, why wouldn't he want Achish to know? Or isn't he, like, eliminating Achish's enemies?
He's eliminating Achish's people.
Look at verse 10. So David said, after Achish asked, where are you making raids today? Against the Negev of Judah. Okay, where's Negev? You guys know geography now? The south. And that's like Fresno County. Big, nondescript area of land. In the south of Judah. Like part of Judah's land. In that area, boss. Against the Negev of the Jeremelites and against the Negev of the Kenites. Now, these are people that are friendly with Israel, but would have been enemies of Achish. So David is not honest about who he's fighting with. We get a description in verse 8 of the folks he actually fights, which some of may have been questionable as to whether Achish would have been friends or enemies with those. But the people that are mentioned in the Negev of Judah, the Negev of the Jeremelites, and the Kenites, these are all enemies of Achish. So he kind of tells a white lie, a not exact truth. Was I in that area? Yeah, más o menos. Did you actually fight those people? Kinda, right? So he's being deceptive to make sure that, what's his end goal with that? Why would he not tell the truth to Achish? What's he trying to demonstrate to Achish? I'm fighting against the Israelites. That's what he tells him. What's he trying to do between he and Achish? Why would he tell Achish, I'm fighting against Israel, basically?
Alliance.
I'm not on their team anymore. I've switched teams. Mid-game, I switched teams. I'm your team. Your enemies are my enemies. Okay? Now, what do you think God's going to do about that? David is living a lie, and he's been living it now for 16 months. Where's this going to go? What happens when the normal situation occurs and the Philistines decide that they're going to attack Israel? Now what is David going to do? That's exactly what happens. Okay? David did not leave a man or woman alive in verse 18. Otherwise, they would tell us that David has done this, and this has been his practice at the time he lived in the country. So again, we see a season where God gives allowance for this type of battle when David, or Joshua rather, is taking down fortified cities in the land. And this is the practice. It's not the norm. I think in this situation, this is sin. This is not what God wanted. David is extinguishing people that are not called to be extinguished. Okay, so Achish believed David in verse 12, saying he has surely made himself odious among his people, Israel. Therefore, he will become my servant forever. So, again, what's the end game for David in this? What's the goal? Achish thinks I'm on his team. Does Achish believe it? Absolutely. So now Achish takes him in, and he becomes basically his chief armor bearer, his Joab, his Amnon, what's the guy's name? Saul's armor bearer, starts with an A. Gosh, there's too many A names. Abner, thank you. This is what occurs. So for 16 months, this is the lifestyle that he leaves. Now, 28 is a bit of a parenthesis. Okay, so we'll pause on the story for a second. This is a weird story at that. And then in 29, the story that we're currently reading about David and Achish and Gath and Israel, we'll pick back up. Okay, so this is a soap opera, and they just switched to another scene. Okay, I love how they write. They knew about soap operas before we ever wrote about them, right? Or whatever. Okay, 28:1, we're going back to Saul and what's happening during his day and age. So pick up in 28.
In those days, the Philistines gathered their forces for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, understand that you and your men are to go out with me in the army. David said to Achish, very well, you shall know what your servant can do. And Achish said to David, very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life.
All right, so now before we get into the Saul stuff in verse 3, what's the situation in 28:1 and 2? What's just occurred? We're going to go fight Israel. So what's now David going to have to choose between? He's going to have to live his lie, right? So we're going to go fight Israel, and we're going to find out whose team he's really on. And now he's probably wetting his pants. Or maybe he's not. We'll find out, okay? But David is now going to be put in a situation where he's got to live this out. Now, verse 3, Samuel's dead. All of Israel laments for him in Ramah, his own city. Saul removed from the land those who were spiritists and mediums. So any sorcery or whatever that was going on, Saul had removed that from the land. But now he's trying to talk to God, and God shut off the pipeline of conversation. So Saul's in a battle situation again in verse 4. The Philistine had gathered together and come to Shuham, and Saul gathered all of Israel together and camped in Gilboa. Okay, we stood there just a few days ago. Saul comes to the camp of the Philistines, was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. Saul, in verse 6, inquires of God, but the Lord did not answer him either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. So Saul is trying every way to find out, God, what do I do? He's praying, he's consulting priests, he's using the Urim and the Thummim, he's not speaking in dreams. So God Again, and we saw this in the text, God says the Spirit of God left him and he didn't know it, similar to Samson, too many S words. So he's in a bad way. So Saul now is going to throw a Hail Mary, and a desperate one at that. Verse 7, because God's not speaking to him, this is his idea.
And Saul said to his servant, "Seek out for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her." And his servant said to him, "Behold, there is a medium in Endor."
Okay, so literally, like right around the corner from the mountain that they're on, Saul's man tells him, "Hey, there's a medium, there's a sorceress," just kind of like what we would think today. So something of the occult, weird, and Saul says, "Great, get her for me." And he disguises himself in verse 8, goes to this woman because he had kicked out all the mediums and sorceresses, so there's not on the up and up that he does this. And he says to her, "Conjure up for me, please, and bring up for me whom I shall name to you." So what is Saul going for with this medium, this witch? What does that mean? Conjure up for me who I will ask of you. He wants to bring somebody back from the dead. Okay, this is an odd chapter. Okay, verse 9, the woman said, "Behold, I know your salt, like you've ridded all the sorcerers from the land. I know what Saul has done. If I do this, I'm going to get killed. It's going to get found out by Saul." And Saul says, "Look, as the Lord lives," which is odd, he says, "bring up this, you know, person that I ask you, there's going to be no punishment." So the woman said, "Who do you want me to bring up?" Verse 11, Saul says, "Bring up Samuel." So which? I want you to bring Samuel back from the dead so that I can have a conversation with Samuel. Okay? Is anybody weirded out at this point? I'm a little weirded out. Okay? Apparently, this was a normative practice, either by trickery or deception, that witches would do, which is why they were thrown out of the land. But let's watch this story unfold. Okay? Verse 12. Somebody pick up there. Okay, stop there for just a second. So she does her job. The woman conjures up Samuel, and what is her reaction?
She's surprised.
She's surprised. Why would a woman who normally brings up dead people, okay, I put that in quotes because I don't think that's what's going on, be surprised when she conjures up a dead person?
Because
it doesn't actually happen. But this time it actually does happen, and she wigs out. So part of, you know, even the occult today with sorcery and tarot card, whatever that stuff is, right? I don't frequent those places. But it's all deception. It's all great conversational skills. It's all based on lies. Well, when she is confronted with, holy cow, there's a dude walking up. It's actually Samuel. She loses it, okay? And she says, "Why have you deceived me?" And realizes this is Saul, okay? And the king said to her in verse 13, "Do not be afraid. What do you see?" And the woman said, "I see a divine being coming up out of the earth." Weird. Okay, 14, he said to her, "What is his form?" And she said, "An old man is coming up. He is wrapped with the robe." And Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed his face to the ground and did homage. So Samuel is coming back from the dead. Saul gets the description and says, "Yep, that's Samuel." Hasn't seen him yet, but realizes that's who's coming, and they're about to have a conversation. Saul's about to talk to a dead guy that a witch just brought back from the dead. Okay? This is in our Bible. I know. 15. Keep going.
And Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" Saul answered, "I am in great distress, for the Philistines are warring against me, and God has turned away from me and answers me no more, either by prophets or by dreams. Therefore, I have summoned you to tell me what I shall do."
Like, dude, maybe repent. Like, maybe quit being an idiot. But so he's having now a full-on conversation with Samuel. Does it sound like that's a Samuel thus far? Seems like it. Samuel says, "Why then do you ask me, since the Lord has departed from you and has become your adversary?" Is that consistent with what we've seen Samuel say in the past? "Yes, the Lord has done according to as he spoke through me, for the kingdom has been torn out of your hand and given to your neighbor David." That's exactly what Samuel said when he was alive. "You're going to have this kingdom ripped from you, just like I just ripped your robe, and it's going to be given now to your servant David. As you did not obey the Lord and did not execute his fierce wrath on Amalek, so the Lord has done this thing to you this day." You guys remember that story? Saul brought back the king of the Amalekites and said, "I got my prize." And Samuel said, "Hey, I thought I told you to kill everybody." And Saul says, "Oh, the people wanted him alive and all the sheep." And then Samuel has to execute judgment against this guy and kill him. Samuel reminds him of this story. This This is Samuel. Y'all figure it out, but this is Samuel, okay? Moreover, verse 19, the Lord would also give Israel along with you into the hands of the Philistines. Therefore, tomorrow, you and your sons will be with me. What does that mean? You're going to die, you and your sons. Who are his sons? Jonathan and some other dude that we don't care about, okay? Sorry, bud. I'll apologize to him in heaven as well. I don't remember your name. So, Samuel's prophetic and says, because of your disobedience, because of what you're doing, because God is taking the kingdom from you, to demonstrate that once more from the grave, tomorrow you're going to die, you and two of your three sons, okay? Saul immediately fell full length upon the ground, was very afraid because of the words of Samuel, and there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no food all day and all night. So, a bizarre situation. We never see this again in our Bible. We've never seen it since, but God, for some reason, allows this situation to take place, and it seems like Saul actually has a conversation with Samuel in the form that he was in, that Saul knew him in an old man's body of some sort. And Samuel gives this prediction and says, this is what's going to happen tomorrow. And lo and behold, what do you think is going to happen tomorrow? Saul's going to die with Jonathan at Mount Gilboa in battle with the Philistines. So sorry to ruin the story for you if you haven't read it. Okay. Bizarre. So theologically, I have no earthly idea. Okay. This is one of those weird deals. The text says it, so I believe it. How it happened, why it happened, I don't know, but God allows this to take place, and it certainly seems like this is actually Samuel having a conversation with Saul as a dead guy, okay? So, woman came to Saul in verse 21, basically says, look, dude, you need to eat. This is not good. He says, no. She says, no, you really need to do, and that's kind of the end of the chapter, okay? 24, they take a fattened calf. She kills it, feeds that and his men, and now in verse 29 and following, he's going to end up going, or chapter 29 and following, he's going to end up on the battlefield. So, he gets this horrible last news, like, look, dude, you're about to die. What you're doing, you shouldn't have done. And now David in chapter 29, the story returns to him, and we're going to see David now live out this lie with Agag. Pick up now 29:1, or Achish rather, not Agag. All right, so this is kind of in the Jezreel Valley, if you will, up north, and they're getting ready to go to battle. Keep rolling.
As the lords of the Philistines were passing on by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men were passing on in the rear with
Achish.
You've been saying that, Achish. The commanders of the Philistines said, what are these Hebrews doing here? And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me now for days and years, and since he deserted to me, I have found no fault in him to this day.
All right, so all the Philistines are gathering for war, and some of the other, like, commanders of the Philistines go, hey, isn't that David? And aren't these 600 dudes Hebrews? Why are they here? And what does Achish say?
He's been living with me.
This guy rocks, man. He's been with me for a year and a half. He's been fighting battles. He's completely loyal. You know, I've tested him. He's good. Don't worry about it. And they said, no. The Philistines were angry with him. And the commanders of the Philistines said, listen, make the man go back that he may return to his place where you have assigned him. And do not let him go down to battle with us, or in battle he may become an adversary for us. For what could this man make himself acceptable to his lord? Would it not be with the hands of these men? So what is the other lords of the Philistines concern if David goes into battle?
He's
going to rip off his shirt and have the other team shirt underneath, and now he's going to switch teams, and that would make him honorable to Saul, right? Perfect plan. Now, if you're David, this is perfect, yes? So you're going to fake like you really want to go into battle with Achish, and then they're going to say, you know what, you can't. And you're going to go, oh, dang it, really wanted to. But okay, we'll go home. So this is an out. David clearly has the ability to get out. So Achish comes to him and says in verse 6, hey, as the Lord lives, dude, you're awesome. That's the Hebrew in verse 6. You've been great. I found no evil in you. Nevertheless, end of verse 6, you are not pleasing in the sight of the Lord's. I'm good with you, but all my fellow peers and the other kings that we're going to go to battle with, they're saying no go. You got to go home. Verse 7, now therefore, return and go in peace that you may not displease the Lord of the Philistines. Now, again, this is a perfect out for David. If he's truly loyal to Israel and Saul and ultimately his throne, this is what he needs. This is what he's been asking for. He doesn't have to fake it. He gets kicked out. So he doesn't ever have to choose sides. Are you with me? So what should David's response be right now?
Yay.
Yay. You know, fake it. Like, act like you're really upset. But go home and say, awesome. Verse 8.
David said to Achish, but what have I done? What have you found in your servant from the day I entered your service until now, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king?
What is he doing?
He's trying to convince him.
I want to fight. What have I done wrong? What evil have you found in me that I can't go to battle? Go tell your peers that I'm good. We've been doing this for 16 months together. Why can't I go fight? Sorry? Does this make any sense to you? That David is saying, now I want to go fight against my countrymen, my brethren, the Israelites? Like, that's what he's asking to do. Achish says, I know that you are pleasing in my sight like an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines said he must not go into battle. Now then, arise early in the morning with your servants, your Lord, whom you have with you, and as soon as it is early morning, arise and depart. Now, David may have been, I may be rooting his like shrewd conversational skills, so maybe he knows if he offers back, like that's kind of faking it, but he knows Achish isn't going to cave. But what happens if Achish says, you know what, David, you're right. The heck with those guys. You're going to battle with us. Boy, that is a pretty bold ask. And given the 16 months of compromise that David's in, I don't think his head's screwed on straight right now. I don't think he's thinking correctly. And I think that is an honest response. I want to go to battle. Why can't I fight? I've demonstrated my loyalty to you time and time again. And this is where he's at. Now, luckily, Achish breaks kind of the stalemate and says, listen, dude, you're going home. So peace be with you. Great. Verse 11, David arose early, he and his men, to depart in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went to Jezreel. So they're about to have a battle, the battle that Saul is about to die in, that David was begging to get in on. So again, when you talk about just oddities in David's life, I can see some validity, and maybe David's just being really discerning in how to have this conversation, making it look like he wants to fight but really doesn't. It certainly appears from the last 16 months that he is jacked in the head. And it's going to take chapter 30 to get him out of it. Okay? So, good? All right. 30 verse 1 now. Let's watch the results of this battle. Here's what's coming. And I think this is what David did not expect.
Now when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, the Amalekites had made a raid against the Negev and against Ziklag. They had overcome Ziklag and burned it with fire.
All right. What's Ziklag? David's home, right, for the last 16 months. So who's in Ziklag? His family, his wives, his buddy's wives' kids, right? This is bad. Who are the Amalekites? Okay, and what's David been doing to them according to what we saw two chapters ago? Raiding against them. So the Amalekites are down south. Philistine and Israel are going after it. They're battling together. So what do the Amalekites see? Way down south. Oh, look, there's an opportunity. The Philistines are completely consumed with Israel and vice versa. We're going to go into Ziklag, take a bunch of money, a bunch of stuff, a bunch of sheep, candy from a baby. So they walk in. Where's all the men that are supposed to be defending Ziklag? Oh, they're up in Philistine begging to get in the battle, right? So there's nobody in the town. So they take everything. They took captive women, all who were with it, small and great, without killing anyone, and carried them off and went their way. By the grace of God, they walk into town. There's not a male there. So they're like, let's go. Everybody out. You're coming with us. The women, the children, the stuff. They take everything without having to kill one person. The town is abandoned because David and his men aren't there. So are you seeing a little bit of retribution now for David's decisions? Here it comes.
When they take this children like that, are they trying to grow their city? Is that what they're doing? Or why don't they just kill them? Once they have to take care of these people, why do they
cheap labor. They're servants. We're going to convert you to our way of life or whatever. We're going to grow our armies from you. I mean, that's free indoctrination, right? That's the idea. So they're valuable to them in that regard. Okay? Verse 3. Keep reading.
And when David and his men came to the city, they found it burned with fire and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength to weep.
I mean, that's a bad day. I mean, you start looking at what's happened to David. He's lost his identity in chapter 29. He doesn't know whose team he's on anymore. He's a for-hire kind of like just, you know, almost like we saw the priest in the book of Judges, Jonathan, grandson of Moses. It's just like, man, I'm whoever's going to hire me, that's who I'm going to fight for. That's kind of, David's like a mercenary. Loses his identity. He's extremely disillusioned with the current situation that he's in. He now is down spiraling into, I think, a depression. Like, this is bad. So he just finds out, dude, your town's been raided. Now, what is his thought at this point? You walk home and everybody's gone. And he knows the Amalekites have been there. Worst case scenario, what are you thinking?
Dead.
Everybody's dead. My wives are dead. My kids are dead. My buddy's wives are dead. How do you think your 600 boys are going to respond about right now? You think they're happy with David? Look at verse 6.
And David was greatly distressed when the people spoke of stoning him.
Whoa. Time out. These are the same guys that came to his aid, lived in caves with him, are stupid loyal to this guy. 600 of them. And they have just hit rock bottom with David. And what do they say?
Stone him.
Let's take a vote. Who wants to stone David? Oh, only 49%. Okay, let's not stone him. But that's where they're at. I mean, they're at the point where they're literally like, let's just kill him and move on. And then let's go get our wives. Okay, so this is bad. And it takes getting to this point to kind of wake David up from his slumber spiritually. Okay? They spoke of stoning him, for all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters. Now, the first time in 16 months, you see something in David's life. End of verse 6.
But David strengthened himself in the Lord.
Have we seen David pray in 16 months? Have we seen him consult God? No. He's been living in compromise. He's been faking like he's been on Team Philistia, right? I mean, that's been the nature of his interactions with God. But at this point, God has crushed him so much, and he's so at the end of his rope that he finally turns to God. And in verse 7, watch what he does.
And David said to Abiathar, the priest, the son of Ahimelech, bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David.
All right, you guys remember the story? Ahimelech's the guy that was murdered by Saul, by Doeg, and his son is Abiathar, who flees for his life and comes with David. So David's got like the priest that God is speaking through right now. David inquires of the Lord and says, shall I pursue this band? Shall I overtake them? And God speaks to David and says in verse 8, pursue them. You shall surely overtake them, and you shall surely rescue all. So God, even in the midst of David's 16-month compromise, speaks to David. He prays, and God responds. So verse 9, keep going, Haley.
So David set out, and the 600 men who were with him, and they came to the brook Besor, where those who were left behind stayed. But David pursued, he and 400 men, 200 stay behind, who were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor.
All right, so they're at a wadi, a big, a giant, basically, ravine in between two mountains. It would have been we've talked about wadis before, a place where you would walk in the shade in between two mountains, if you will. So they've marched so hard, there's 200 dudes, and these are hard dudes that are like, we're too fried to even go on. 400 now go with David onward. Keep going to 11.
They found an Egyptian in the open country and brought him to David, and they gave him bread, and he ate. They gave him water to drink.
All right, so we find out this guy's escaped from the battle, and he's going to give David news, okay? In verse 13, this is the news.
Do you want me to skip 12?
Yep.
Okay. And David said to him, to whom do you belong, and where are you from? He said, I am a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite, and my master left me behind when I fell sick 3 days ago.
All right, the Amalekites were the people that were just fighting David. So lo and behold, he stumbles upon a guy that's been with the Amalekites. He's like, money, okay? So I've just fed you. Now tell me what's happened. And he says, hey, we made these raids against the Negev, against Judah, against the Negev of Keilah, and we burned Ziklag with fire. So, by the way, that's the situation that David walked in on. Not just his home abandoned, but it had all been set on fire. So David says to me, will you bring me down to this band? And he said, swear to me that by your God that you won't kill me, and I'll show you exactly what happened. So this slave is saying, or this guy that they came upon, hey, if you don't kill me, yes, I'll give you all the insider trading information you want. They, in verse 16, bring them down, eating and drinking. He takes them down to where the Amalekites had camped. Pick up there in verse 16, Haley.
And when he had taken him down, behold, they were spread abroad over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah.
So this guy walks them right into the camp of the Amalekites and says, David, here they are. And they're all partying because they just took, you know, candy from a baby. And they're all basically drunk and partying. 17.
And David struck them down from twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken, and David rescued his two wives. Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that had been taken. David brought back all.
Are you kidding me? Like, how about that gracious act of God? Nobody died. Nothing was taken from them. So they acquire back now their wives, their belongings, their children. I mean, that is amazing grace in the midst of David's sin, right? So it isn't a tit for tat. Did David deserve that? No. Does God give it to him anyway? Yeah. I mean, you're seeing again, I think, David's theology being shaped. Like, God, my righteousness does not warrant you now giving me what I ask of you. That's not how this works. God is God and you are not. And God is gracious to him in this moment. David captured all the sheep and the cattle in verse 20 and drove ahead of the other livestock. And they said, this is the spoil of David. 21, when David came to the 200 men who were too exhausted to follow David, the guys that they left at the Wadi, they approached him to greet David. And 22, watch what they say.
Then all the wicked and worthless fellows among the men who had gone with David said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except that each man may leave his wife and children and depart.
So the 400 that went and fought, how do they feel about the 200 that hung out with all the bags?
You don't get anything.
Like, you get nothing, right? Now, knowing David's history, how is he going to respond to this?
He's going to let them have spoil.
Yeah, keep going.
But David said, you shall not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us. He has preserved us and given into our hands the band that came against us. Who would listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down into the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage.
Right. These guys were too exhausted to fight, and David says, we're going to take care of them. They're going to get their portions. We're not going to do that. Okay, 25. So it had been, and it's a statute, 25 says from this day forward, that's kind of the statute in Israel. Okay, 26, when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, behold, a gift for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. Now, 26 and following, David takes all this spoil from the Amalekites, and then he sends basically packages to Judah, Bethel in verse 27, all those who were in the Negev, those in Jatir, wherever that is, in verse 27, 28, you see all these cities mentioned, 29, those who were in Rakal, the Jeremelites in verse 29, the Kenites in verse 29, those who were in Horma in verse 30, Borashan in 30, all, 31, those who were in Hebron, in all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to go. What is David doing?
He's making amends.
Yeah, maybe not amends. Maybe with Judah.
Gaining favor.
Absolutely. He's saying thank you. Look, I've been on the run for 11 years. You guys housed me. You allowed me to stay in your land. And he's sending thank you notes, right? With some sweet, like, here's a fatty gift card to Starbucks while I'm at it, right? He's just basically, he's being wise, right? He knows he's going to go rule the land at one day. His senses are, it looks like, back with him. So he sends stuff to Judah, which is kind of where he's going to begin to rule first. And he's saying, hey, thank you. So this is brilliant. This is political in a sense, but it's also very, David isn't a jerk, right? He has spoiled the share. He shares it, and he's saying thank you to the men that have protected his life now for the last 11 years. He's not going to pull a Nabal and say, I'm sorry, who are you? Whose son are you? I don't know who you are. These are my sheep. This is my stuff. I want them in battle. You didn't do nothing. I'm going to keep it all. He says, no, thank you guys for taking care of me. I would be dead had these cities not taken care of him. Okay, so it is a very, very smart move on David's part. Okay, so I think at this point, David's finally back on the up and up. He's got his head screwed on straight. He's walking with the Lord again. And in 31 now, we're going to see what we have been waiting for, what David has been waiting for and hoping for in a non-sick and twisted way. But I am not going to touch the Lord's anointed. God, if you want to deal with this dude, you're going to deal with this dude. I'm not touching him. 31, God is now going to deal with Saul.
Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab.
Oh, it's three of his sons. My bad. I got to apologize to both of those guys now.
And Malchishua and the sons of Saul.
It's a long list, man. So.
Battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was badly wounded by the archers.
All right, so Saul His two sons die, so Jonathan, three sons. Jonathan is dead. His other two sons are dead. Saul is mortally wounded, but not dead. Okay. Verse 3, the battle went heavy against Saul. The archers hit him, badly wounded, but not dead. 4, Saul says now to his armor bearer, who's with him on Mount Gilboa, draw your sword, pierce me through with it. Otherwise, these uncircumcised Philistines, is the idea, will come and pierce me through and make sport of me. Like, man, they're going to come upon me, the king. I'm going to be a laughingstock. They're going to cut off my head. They're going to mess with me. Just, can we just get this over, you know, quick? But his armor bearer would not do it. So he has enough honor to say, dude, I am not running my sword through you. You're the king. That ain't going to happen. Okay, so what is Saul's, what does he do? End of verse 4.
Therefore, Saul took his own sword and fell upon it.
Okay, so Saul basically commits suicide at the end of his life. And he's going to die either way, but in order to get it over with quicker, he just falls on his sword. Okay. Armor bearer saw the same thing that Saul does and realized, man, this is going to end badly for me. And he repeats the same action and also commits suicide. So both these guys now are slain dead on Mount Gilboa. His armor bearer sees that, does the same. Okay, Saul died with his three sons, his armor bearer in verse 6, and all his men on that day together. Okay, it is, by the way, a bad situation in Israel. Philistines are encroaching in their area. It's rough, and now we've got Saul, Jonathan, and his other two sons dead. Okay. When the men of Israel in verse 7 were on the other side of the valley with those who were beyond the Jordan, Saul, the men of Israel had fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead. They abandoned the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and lived in them. So again, losing ground, losing influence. The Philistines are winning the day. Verse 8, pick up there.
The next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. So they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. They put his armor in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beth Shean,
okay, which we stood at like a week ago, okay, where Saul's body was hung, okay, city in Israel, and the Philistines had taken control of it, and they are making now a mockery, and that's what you do, right? You take a king like David did with Goliath's head and say, here's your boy, like, what are you going to do now, right? I got his head. So, rough day. These men now fasten his body to the wall of Beth Shean. And in verse 11, this is a cool kind of rest of the story. See if this rings a bell for any of you guys. Matt can't answer.
But when the inhabitants of
Jabesh Gilead.
I got it.
Oh, my bad. Sorry.
Heard what the Philistines had done to Saul.
Hey, if you got it, you got to read it. Come on now.
Jabesh Gilead.
Jabesh, but that was close.
Jabesh Gilead.
Very good.
Heard what the Philistines had done to Saul. All the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his son from the wall of Beth Shean, and they came to Jabesh, and burn them there.
All right, who are these dudes? Who are the men of Jabesh Gilead? And why would they march all night long, take Saul's body off a wall, and bring his body back to Beth Shean, or from Beth Shean to Jabesh? Those men ring a bell. I will give 2 bonus points on the exam for anybody that can remember that.
Saul rescued him.
Tell me the story, Adolf.
I just have the note that says Saul rescued him.
It's so cheating. You guys remember Saul got anointed king, and what does he do after he gets oil dumped on his head? It was a good effort, though. I would have done that for 2 points as well. It's totally worth it. He goes back to plow on the field. You guys remember that? And he gets word that Nahash, king of the Amorites, came in to a group of people who lived in Jabesh Gilead and said, we're going to take you. And the guy said, oh, wait. Let's send letters out and see if someone will come help us. And Nahash said, I'm going to stick knives in your eyes. How do you like that? And they said, just give us 7 days, and then you can do that. And they said, okay. Send out letters to Saul. Saul gets the letter while he's plowing his fields, took his donkeys or his oxen, cuts them in pieces, and then FedExes packages all across Israel and says, the same's going to happen to you if you don't come and fight for these guys. He rallies like 200,000 people. They march all night long and go rescue the men of Jabesh Gilead from that dude named Nahash, whose name means snake, by the way. So he must have been a dirty king. This was 40 years ago. And the men of Jabesh Gilead, when they find out that Saul's body has been dishonored, by the way, they live on the east side of the Jordan, so they march, I think it's like 30 miles uphill all night long. What do they do? Like, man, that matters to us. Saul was good to us. We're going to honor him. We're loyal to him. We would all be dead without him for something that happened 40 years ago. So they covert, go in, take his body off the wall, march him all the way back to Jabesh, and give him a proper burial there. So even in the midst of not the best reign, Saul's got some dudes that are loyal to him. So that's the men of Jabesh-Gilead. Very cool. Okay, so they take care of him and basically honor him. Verse 13, they took their bones. This is Jonathan, this is Saul and the sons, and buried them underneath the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted for 7 days. Okay, so cool ending to his life. I guess if there's an upside to being slain in battle by the Philistines, there you go. So the men of Jabesh-Gilead are quite honorable in what they did. Okay, 2 Sam. Let's keep going, shall we? We got half an hour. Now, this story picks up exactly where we left off, so there's not even a break in the action. It came about, verse 1, after the death of Saul, David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites to go live in Ziklag. So he goes back to his hometown, he lives there, and David gets word from a dude regarding this battle in verse 2.
On the third day, behold, a man came to Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid homage. David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I've escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me."
All right, so David obviously has been dealing with the Amalekites. Ziklag, he has no idea what's happened with the battle, but he knows Philistines and Israel has been fighting. So he's like, "Hey, what happened?" Okay, keep rolling.
And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people had fallen and are dead. And Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead."
So he just finds out now for the first time. Jonathan, his boy, is dead. Saul, his nemesis, if you will, is dead. And it's now in verse 5. He wants confirmation that this is indeed the case. Verse 5.
Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?"
All right, now listen to this story, okay? It's going to sound very familiar, but there's some oddities about it.
And the young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear. And behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me and answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers.'"
Does this all sound familiar? Right? Like, this sounds like exactly what happened, okay? But,
"So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen."
Whoa. Wait a second. What did we just read last chapter? How did Saul die?
He killed himself.
Why?
Because that guy wouldn't kill him.
The other did, right? The armor bearer says, "Man, I don't want any part of killing the king, so no thank you." So apparently this guy, this Amalekite that we're reading about now, watched this whole scene go down and saw Saul die, fell on his sword, sees the now armor bearer that's like, "Man, that was a good idea. I think I'll do the same so I don't get made sport of," and kills himself, and there's nobody else around. So he sees an opportunity. "So I stood beside him," in verse 11, "and killed him because I knew that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown which was on his head and the bracelet which was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my lord." What is this guy's plan?
Don't kill him.
Yeah, he wants a reward. So he saw this. There's no one to confirm what happened. So he takes Saul's crown, takes all the identification marks of Saul, and brings them to David. Does he know who David is?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So he knows this is the next king of Israel. Now, the problem with this guy's theology is what? What does he not know about David and Saul and Saul's position? Yeah. You don't jack with him, right? I don't care who you are, but he doesn't understand that David is not like other kings that would be rejoicing in this situation and dancing on the grave of Saul saying, "I'm glad you're dead," and spitting on his grave, right? So David says now in verse 11, he tears his clothes. He's going basically into mourning. They mourned and they wept and they fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan. So, by the way, this isn't just about Jonathan, and you're going to see that consistently in the rest of this text. He's not just mourning the loss of his friend. He's mourning the loss of Saul, even though there's not a good relationship between these two. Okay, so all night long, they fast until evening. From morning until evening. And now he's going to deal with this dude. He's told him this story. 13.
And David said to the young man who told him, "Where do you come from?" And he answered, "I am the son of a sojourner, an Amalekite."
So I think he's making him repeat a story for a reason. Like, "Are you telling me the truth? Where are you from again?" Keep going.
David said to him, "How is it you out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed.
Oh, now he's getting some different theology, right? This guy thought he was coming for a reward, and now he's about to get in something in 15 that he wasn't expecting.
Then David called one of the young men and said, "Go execute him." And he struck him down so that he died.
Okay. And David's response in verse 16 is this.
And David said to him, "Your blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed."
So whether this is true or not, I don't know. But if you said that you killed the Lord's anointed, then you're going to die. Like, that is what you're getting. So out of the testimony of your own mouth, you get to own that. Benaiah, or whatever dude was next to David at that point, strike this guy down, and he kills him immediately. Now, in 17 and following, this is what is so different about David and other kings. Watch what he does.
And David lamented with his lamentation over Saul and Jonathan, his son, and he said, "It should be taught to the people of Judah. Behold, it is written in the book of Jashar."
You see 19 and following? What is all that? Yeah, he writes a song. He writes a psalm. So in his lamenting, he literally is, he writes words down and teaches it to Israel to say, this is not a good day. Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on high places. Who is he speaking of?
Saul
right? How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, or the daughters of the Philistines will rejoice. The daughters of the uncircumcised will exult. Like, don't spread this news. This isn't good. We don't want our enemies rejoicing. Our king has fallen. O mountains of Gilboa, where did Saul die?
Gilboa.
On Gilboa. Let not dew or rain be on you for fields, nor fields for offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. Why would David be calling for there to be no rain on this mountain? What is that a sign of? Rain is a sign of blessing, right? So he's calling for a drought. He's calling for mountains mourn, like we're mourning. Look, make it gray and nasty and brittle, and that needs to be, that's the condition of our heart. So let not be Gilboa blessed right now. For the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan in verse 22 did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. These men were valiant. They fought. They did their job, and they lost. Saul and Jonathan, beloved in their in pleasant in life, and in their death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul. Can you believe that David could pen these words after being chased by him for 11 years? Think about that. This guy wanted him dead. He's been trying to kill him for 11 years. That has been Saul's main purpose in life. And David has the perspective and ability to write this about his enemy for all intents and purposes. That's amazing to me. I would have danced on his grave, and amongst other things. That his perspective amazes me in a time of difficulty. And this is genuine. This is legit. This is in the moment reaction. So, how the mighty have fallen in the midst of battle. Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan, in verse 26. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. How the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. We talked about this idea before. So if it doesn't mean what I told you it doesn't mean, what does that mean? That Jonathan's love was more wonderful than the love of a woman. What was unique between a man and a woman? And today, still unique between a man and a woman. In terms of what they make between one another.
Yeah.
That too. A covenant was the word I was looking for, but yes, they do know each other, so you guys remember some stuff. There's a covenant. And David is saying of Jonathan, your covenant with me was in some ways stronger than the covenant of marriage, the bond before a man and a wife. Your commitment to me superseded that. Your willingness to fight for me and to be on my team is mind-boggling. You guys are terrible. I need to ask you better questions. So, apparently. It's too early in the morning. Verse 2, all right, or chapter 2, rather. Let's move on before we get stuck in this tar pit of Sodom too long. All right, now, Saul's dead. We've lamented. What's David's next question at this point?
Should I go home?
Lord, what do you want me to do? Like, what do I do next now, right? I've been waiting for this for, like, at this point now, we're talking about 16 to 18. Is that right? Yeah, David was 13 when he's anointed. He's almost 30 at this point, okay? So we're talking about 15, 16, 17, 18 years of waiting. Verse 1 of chapter 2.
After this, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up." David said, To which shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron."
Okay, so Hebron is where Saul is ruling from right now in that area. Who is stuck in the midst of Judah? What tribe?
Benjamin.
Where is Saul from? Benjamin. So who is loyal in this area? Where is their allegiance to? Saul. And where does God tell him to go? Go to Saul's territory, okay? And go have a conversation with these boys. Okay, watch what happens.
So David went up there, and his two wives also, Hanoam of Jezreel, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David brought up his men who were with him, everyone with his household, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and they anointed David.
Wow. So how do they respond? What's the natural response if this was not from the Lord? Who should be the next king? There's one remaining son, by the way, of Saul. His name's Ishbosheth, okay? He's a puppet. He's an idiot. And he's actually going to take over the entire north. So Judah's down south. We're beginning to see that division play out more so. But Ishbosheth is going to be the puppet king in the north. He's going to be controlled by a marionette, okay? Is that the guy that controls the puppet? Marionette,
yeah.
Or stringer? He's a marionette.
Yeah.
This guy, okay? Ishbosheth is the puppet, okay? But these men accept him, okay? Listen in verse, keep rolling.
When they told David it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul, David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead.
Hold on, okay. So what did David just find out? Now, if David has evil intentions, what's the problem with the men of Jabesh-Gilead at this point?
They were loyal to Saul.
We're on Saul's team. And if you're a normal king, what are you going to do to those people? You're going to kill them all. Okay, you've clearly demonstrated your loyalty to my enemy. You're all going to die. Watch what David does.
And David said to them, "May you be blessed by the Lord, because you showed this loyalty to Saul, your lord, and buried him. Now may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you, and I will do good to you because you have done this thing. Now therefore, let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your lord is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them."
Okay, so this is a bit of a, obviously it's a gracious move. It's also a political move. Why would David do this?
Earn some votes.
Yeah. If the people that are the most loyal to Saul will embrace David, right? As a Republican, if I can get the extreme Democrats to vote for me, then everybody's going to vote for me, right? Like, if those guys can tolerate David, then everybody can tolerate David. That's kind of the idea. So he's saying, man, if you guys who have clearly sworn your allegiance to Saul will accept me as king, and oh, by the way, the house of Judah has anointed me king over you, Saul's heritage, will you embrace me? And in fact, they do. So this is a brilliant political move, and David is not dumb in that regard. He knows, man, if I cut these guys off and if I start starting skirmishes with people that were loyal to Saul, it's never going to end. He embraces them and rewards them, okay? The problem here is in verse 8 and what's happening behind the scenes in the north.
But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and he made him king over Gilead and the Asherites and Jezreel and Ephraim and Benjamin and all Israel. All
right, so everything in the north, Abner, who's Saul's lieutenant general, says, "The heck with you, David. I want power." Ishbosheth is too dumb to tie his own shoes, so he says, "Hey, you're going to be the king." And he doesn't know that he's controlled by Abner, but he is. So Abner is looking for power because he's a shrewd dude. And now all the north are loyal now to Saul's son, Ishbosheth, fourthborn, and he was a dummy head. Okay, so we find out he's 40 years old. Saul had now reigned for 42 years-ish. But the house of Israel follows him. Verse 10, the house of Judah follows David. Okay? Now, keep going.
Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was
11,
king.
I'm sorry.
11?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months.
All right, now think about this. So David has been promised by God this kingdom way back in 1 Samuel 16. It's taken God 16, 17-ish years to give him the kingdom. And how much of it does he get? He gets two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. The other 10 tribes are up north with Ishbosheth. And this is the situation for 7 years and 6 months. So he does not have reign over all of Israel yet. But David's patient, and he allows things to kind of play out. And Abner is going to force David's hand at this point. Okay, look at verse 12.
Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, the one on one side of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool.
All right, so we've got David. Okay, who is Joab to David? That's his chief commander. Okay, and then you've got Ishbosheth and Abner. So you've got two kings and two general warriors, okay, that they're the heads of a state, if you will, of their armies. Okay, Abner says to Joab, "Let the young men arise and hold a contest before us." And Joab says, "Okay, I'm good with that. Let them arise." So they went over by count 12 men from Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 from the servants of David. So they now are going to line up like a 12v12 battle, okay? Similar to what we saw with Goliath, right? Saying, hey, I'm the best of the Philistines. Israel, send out your best. And instead of fighting the entire battle, we'll have our best men fight. And whoever wins, wins, okay? And we'll become your servants or vice versa, okay? Verse 16, this is an odd way that they're going to go about this. It's basically chicken before there was footloose, okay?
And each caught his opponent by...
That was really funny, and none of you. Curse all of you. Have you not seen Footloose? Are none of you saved? Seriously, the original, Kevin Bacon? All of you go watch Footloose. That's horrible. Horrible! I can't believe I've been teacher sometimes. I'm so disappointed in all of you right now. Go watch Footloose.
Do I get my 2 points?
I will give you only 2 points. The first person that writes me a one-page summary of the movie Footloose with Kevin Bacon, not the new one. You will get 2 points in your exam.
And each caught his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side, so they fell down together. Therefore, that place was called Helkath Hazar.
All right, so the picture is this, okay? You've got your sword in your right hand, you have your arm on your opponent's shoulder, and you put your sword on their side, okay? And the same thing is happening the other way. So they've got their sword on your side, and it's chicken. Ready? Go. Who's going to flinch? Who's going to move? And who's going to stab each other? So nobody flinched. So everybody stabbed each other. So 24 people died. So problem is, nothing's been decided. So we just saw 24 men go down together. Each one seized his opponent by the head, thrust his sword into his opponent's side. They fell down together. Okay, so the purpose of this was to decide who's the big boy on the block, and everyone basically lost. Okay, so now they're going to go to the battle. 17. Okay, so Abner loses. So David's men are prevailing. Now watch what happens.
And the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel.
Okay, so remember these guys. These are all brothers. These are David's cousins. I think that's how it works. Okay, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. Okay, three brothers, cousins of David. Abishai was the guy that stood over Abner's head earlier with the spear and said, David, let me run him through like quick, fast, and hurry right now. I won't have to do it twice. Okay, same guy. They now flee after Asahel, in verse 19, pursues Abner and did not turn to the right or the left from following Abner. Abner looked behind him as he's fleeing from this battle, and Asahel is in pursuit. He says, is that you, Asahel? And he says, yep, it's me. Abner said to him, look, dude, you don't want none of this, okay? Turn to your left or to your right. Take a hold of one of your young men for yourself. Take for yourself the spoil. He basically says, go kill somebody else, but you don't want to mess with me. So I'm giving you an out. So Abner says, leave, okay? You don't want to go one-on-one with me. You're going to lose the battle. This is why Abner is running away. Abner is a young man. I'm sorry, Abner is an older man. Asahel is a younger, zealous, like eyes on fire, zeal, but not a whole lot of knowledge, if you will, type dude, okay? Yeah, so he's apparently wicked fast as well, okay? So, which is why he's chasing down Abner, who's older and can't outrun him, okay? But he's giving him an out. So, Asahel isn't going to take him up on the offer. He says again in verse 22, turn aside. Why should I strike you to the ground? For then how could I lift up my face to your brother Joab? So he realizes, man, if we start this, we're going to start a family feud. Joab's going to want my life. This is going to end poorly. Leave me alone. Okay? 23 now. Ashahel should have listened. Eric, pick up there in 23.
He refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear, so that the spear came out at his back.
I mean, that's the butt of his spear, the back end of his spear. He took the round end of his spear and ran him through. He warned him. He said, don't mess with me. And Ashahel decided that he wasn't going to listen. He dies like that, and he fell there and died on the spot. It came about that all who had come to the place said Ashahel had fallen and died and stood still. Now, we're about to learn a lot about Joab in this process. Okay, 24, keep reading.
But Joab and Ashahel?
Abishai, is Abishai? That the other brother.
Okay. Pursued Abner, and as the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which lies before Gia on the way to the wilderness of Gibeon. And the people of Benjamin gathered themselves together behind Abner, became one group and took their stand on the top of the hill. Then Abner called to Joab, shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn from the pursuit of their brothers?
Okay, so what's Abner saying?
Stop.
Dude, stop. Like, you won the battle. I'm running away. I just killed your brother who wouldn't relent. If this keeps going, what's going to happen? This is a civil war, by the way. This is Israel fighting Israel. So, like, look, leave it alone. Like, I admit that you've won the day, okay? And Joab is just, he's angry. His brother's dead. He wants vengeance. And now in verse 27, watch what he does.
And Joab said, as God lives, if you have not spoken, surely the men would not have given up the pursuit of their brothers until the morning. So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the men stopped and pursued Israel no more. No, nor did they fight anymore. All
right, so Joab calls off the battle. What do you think Joab's intent, though, is? What's going to continue to occur within this guy? You think he's just going to let it go that easy? We're going to find out that he's not. Joab is a fascinating guy who's loyal to David, but he is the definition of a loose cannon. Okay, he's great. He is skilled in battle. He's super gifted, but he's uncontrollable. Okay, he is not able to be leashed. Joab does what Joab wants to do. Okay. This day, he realizes, you know what? Abner's right. This is going to end poorly. So it's in my best interest to not. Abner and his men then went to the Arabah all night, place that we read about yesterday, the Yeshimon. Okay, they crossed the Jordan and walked all morning and came to Mahanaim. They go to the east side of the Jordan and flee from David and his men. Joab returned from following Abner, and he gathered all the people together, 19 of David's servants. Besides Ashahel were missing, but the servants of David had struck down many of Benjamin and Abner's men. I'm sorry, I told you guys earlier that Benjamin stayed with David. Benjamin went with Israel to the north. And 360 men died that day. And they took Ashahel and buried him in his father's tomb, which was in Bethlehem. Then Joab and his men went all night long, and the dawn broke at Hebron. So they end up marching home. Okay? So that's the picture here. So let's pause there for today. We'll pick up on the rest of the story next week and watch now David's kingdom begin to unfold as he gains power, but it's not starting so well with these inner city rivals, if you will.